Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of May. It's All Things Political. We have two guests with us this hour, Sam Stein, political reporter from the Huffington Post, and later Philip Klein, senior writer for the Washington Examiner. We're still learning more and more about the death of Osama bin Laden and how the United States accomplished this. The president was on 60 Minutes last night, giving a very lengthy interview, and I'd like to start our conversation this hour talking about that. We, of course, will also branch into the economy and look at the Republican presidential field for 2012. But I'd like to spend the first part of the show talking about our relationship with Pakistan and whether or not they knew what was going on here. And the president did say that they have been a very strong supporter, strong counter-terror partner. He said in that interview that we have killed more terrorists on Pakistani soil than anywhere else. What about our relationship with Afghanistan, and how do we remove troops, and when should we from that country? So we have a lot to talk about in the aftermath of the death of bin Laden. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Sam Stein is a political reporter at Huffington Post. He was previously working for Newsweek magazine, the New York Daily News, and the investigative journalism group Center for Public Integrity. He's a graduate of Dartmouth, and we're delighted to have him with us the first part of our program. Hello, Sam.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for being with us. What did you think of the president's appearance on 60 Minutes last night?
I thought it was very good for the White House. I thought he came off very sensible, sort of sober almost in the post-Bin Laden killing aftermath, and very very much you know, the adult in the room. And I think that you know, he was very measured with his with what he said. He didn't want to gloat over the fact that this was a major political achievement. And he was also sensitive to the fact that you need to be delicate with how we treat Pakistan in the aftermath. And so I think he touched all the bases. You know, I don't see any downside for him going on 60 Minutes and doing this, and I think he just made the case that he's a competent commander-in-chief.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing, though, that those people must have been very nervous because, as he said, it was a 55-45 situation. They were entering the sovereign territory of another country, and he did ask the question, what if it were not bin Laden? It was a prince from Dubai who was there.
Well, I thought that was actually a little far-fetched, considering all the circumstantial evidence. They knew that this house was protected by 12 to 18 foot high walls. There was no internet or phone access. People were very rarely going in and out. When cricket balls were knocked over the fence, they would not give them back to the kids who knocked them over. So it would be hard for me to imagine that the Prince of Dubai would somehow have those security measures taken in a suburban village in Pakistan. But, you know, that being said, it was a very sensitive call, and obviously a very risky one if the intelligence was only at 55-45, as the president said. And, you know, I think history is sort of filled with examples of those things blowing up, so to speak, in the face of the person
Yes.
who ordered them. And obviously that was weighing on the president before he made this call. On the other hand, though, this was sort of one of the major planks of his foreign policy platform when he ran for office, the idea that if we had actionable intelligence on Osama bin Laden's whereabouts, we would not hesitate to act. And, you know, it's refreshing in some respect to see someone follow through on a promise like that.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the intelligence that was gathered at that compound, I would imagine they found some pretty good leads. Do you think that there will be leads, and do you know anything about possible leads to other terrorists as a result of this?
I'm very confident that there will be good information extracted from that, and nothing that will be shared with, you know, me or anyone else, probably, in terms of operational information. But you have to imagine, according to U.S. officials, they picked up hard drives, computers, communiques. Obviously, they picked up videos, like the ones that were released yesterday. Those are probably the most insensitive ones, and ones that put Osama bin Laden in the worst light. This was beyond just capturing and killing Osama bin Laden. This was a massive victory in terms of intelligence gathering, and I can only imagine that the stuff that was called from that house is probably more significant than everything we've put together prior to that day from September 11th. It's got to be that big a treasure chest.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the relationship with Pakistan right now, which has to be darn tricky. The president talking about there being a strong counter-terrorist partner, that we've killed more terrorists on Pakistani soil than anywhere else, and yet they're sounding pretty defensive today that they, you know, weren't lackluster about this, that, you know, that they're smarter than people are thinking that they are right now. Well, tell me about the nuances of the relationship with Pakistan and the problems with that relationship right now.
Well, obviously, there's multiple layers to the nuance here. Obviously, there's the fact that Pakistan and India have longstanding hostilities over their border, and the U.S. has been sort of delicately balancing out support for both countries at once. There's obviously the history of nuclear weapons between the two countries and the race for them. In more recent times, though, it's very difficult for the U.S. to be too hard on Pakistan, in part because they are the base through which we send many of our planes that go to Afghanistan, and we need that. Not to mention that if the leadership in Pakistan were to fall, the most likely successor would be elements of sort of Muslim extremism, which is sort of explains why Pakistan's in a tough situation themselves, because they have to be critical of the U.S. for doing what it did. They are a sovereign country, after all. But they, at the same time, they're very reliant on U.S. aid, and they need, they need the billions of dollars that we send them in terms of, you know, civil help, but also military help. Or else the government would fall apart in all likelihood. So this is probably the toughest outcome of what we did is what does this mean diplomatically? I think Obama was right there. You know, there are questions that need to be asked, because either Pakistani intelligence was complicit in hiding bin Laden, or they are just completely incompetent. And there is more than likely, as the president said, a support structure for bin Laden in Pakistan that needs to be rooted out. And I'm guessing that the intelligence that we picked up from Osama bin Laden's compound will help us out with that.
Mm-hmm. And what sense are you getting on response from the Pakistanis about our entering their sovereign country? Are there a lot of demonstrations taking place or not?
Well, the Pakistani ambassador to America has been very vocal in his disappointment with what happened. And you can sense that what he's saying is reflecting domestic political considerations in that country. It's not ideal from their standpoint that we launched an attack in their country, and not only that, but didn't alert them or coordinate with them on it. Operationally, it was probably a necessity for Obama to do that, but it doesn't negate the fact that they're upset about it. In terms of what it means long-term, I'm not entirely sure. I think we'd have to wait and see. They don't really have much of a leg to stand on,
right?
Because they were, after all, Osama bin Laden was not only in the country, but it was in sort of right under the military's nose. And that is cause for deep concern and skepticism over what they're doing there. So they can howl to, their breath is, or until their throats are sore, but they don't really have much of a moral high ground here.
Mm-hmm. And why is it that Muslim extremism still has a fairly strong hold in Pakistan?
I wish I knew better, and I'd have to probably study up a little bit more on that. This is very much a tribal country. There is not sort of the governing infrastructure that can reach into a lot of those regions that would, sort of negate that type of sense. Part of it's simply that people who are supporting them in terms of their civil infrastructure are extremist people who, and then the other part is, of course, that a lot of the extremists have fled over the border from Afghanistan. So in that northwest region, you have a huge amount of problems. There's national security. And I don't think the Pakistani government has the type of resources that could effectively negate that.
Mm-hmm. In terms of Afghanistan, the president was asked about our relationship and what will happen with that war as a result of the capture. He talked about July beginning to draw down troops and saying again that Afghanistan needs to secure itself. We need to train Afghans to stabilize the country. How are we doing in those regards?
Well, this is a good question, and obviously there's been some lawmakers on Capitol Hill who've taken the the incident of Osama bin Laden being killed and sort of pivoted from that and said, well, now we really need to rethink our policy in Afghanistan. And you can see and you can make the argument that in a long-term sense, the administration would be wise in some respects to say, well, now we can accelerate our withdrawal. It just, because in many respects, Osama bin Laden was the figurehead for why we went into Afghanistan in the first place. The problem with that is that it's long since been a problem in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda has long since gone away from being the primary problem in Afghanistan. The primary problem in Afghanistan is the governing infrastructure and the inability for them to sort of root out corruption. Obviously, opium and the drug trade is a problem as well. Al-Qaeda only, I think, Leon Panetta, the now soon-to-be former CIA chief, said there's only 50 Al-Qaeda members in Afghanistan. So what you're hearing from the administration is sort of caution with the idea that they're going to hasten the withdrawal. They say, well, you know, we still need to make sure that the government is built up so that they no longer can be taken over by extremists. We don't want it to become a route for terrorists in the future, and we're not rethinking what is the plan to start phasing the withdrawal in July of 2011. So I'm not entirely sure that you're going to expect massive fundamental change in that policy.
Mm-hmm. And will the president be criticized for that?
Yes, I think so, and I'd have to say probably with some good reason. You hear a lot of people wondering, you know, we're living in an age of domestic austerity, but we spend hundreds of, you know, millions, if not billions of dollars on a monthly basis. I think we did a story where we calculated the cost from 9/11 to the capturing of bin Laden, and between the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and aid to Pakistan and national security measures, it was $1.28 trillion.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and so there's going to be people domestically who are going to say, well, why are we spending that when we've captured the top of Al-Qaeda and we could be spending money on schools in the United States?
$1.28 trillion. I'm still back at that statement. Wow.
Yes.
Wow. Your site, Huffington Post, has right now its lead story, Pakistani media reporting what they say is the name of the CIA station chief in Islamabad, which evidently is not who it really is. But what in the world is this all about? Why are they doing that?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Huffington Post, just in the last few minutes, I think, has a major story on Pakistani media reporting what they say is the name of the CIA station chief in Islamabad.
God, I don't know. I mean, that's a curious thing to report, I guess. But, I think, it gets back to the fact that there is massive frictions between the two countries right now. I'm not entirely sure why Pakistani media is trying to do this. It doesn't really help matters all that much.
Right.
I think there's a sense in that country that they want to be seen as sort of not subversive to U.S. interests and, not definitely their own sovereign nation. So perhaps this is a retaliatory thing.
We go to phone calls. Sam Stein is our guest. It's All Things Political. Sam is political reporter for the Huffington Post. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email, you can use that as well, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, we're going to have a philosophical discussion about targeted killing. And we will have as our guest a philosophy professor at Rutgers University. Sam Stein is with us now. Phone calls starting with Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'd like to talk about the concept of the self-fulfilling prophecy, which I think is a very useful way of looking at any number of issues. And it can be applied in your thinking to any political group, where be they libertarian, Republican, corporate Democrat, or liberal Democrat. And in the process, you state that there's a problem. And you say that if we don't deal with this problem, it's going to get worse. And then, but of course, in the process, you don't mention what you did to help create the problem. You don't mention that you're obstructing solutions to the problem, or that you indeed have any solutions to the problem, and you don't mention that you might be exacerbating the problem. And I just wanted to show people how this might be intertwined with a couple of issues, namely the lack of jobs and the debt. So, for example, the the debt gets created because of the wars and also the tax breaks for the rich, among other things, but also because of job cuts in the past years, going back to the Bush era, and the result of the job cuts are that, of course, revenues are cut because people don't have income to pay taxes, and also revenues are depleted because the debt is exacerbated because of the fact that unemployment compensation is being paid out to people. Now, as a result of this, of course, people have less discretionary money to spend, and this money then isn't spent, for example, on going out to restaurants, and restaurant people get laid off, and people... And then, of course, they don't have the revenues to give to the government, and also UC is depleted with them. So it becomes an endless cycle. And at the same time, of course, the Republicans will fight job creation programs and will fight programs that might change the laws that encourage people to export jobs in the first place. And then when all is said and done in all of this, they come back to the people and say, well, you see, we told you so.
Sam.
There's a lot to unpackage there. I would start with the fact that, you know, part of what Bin Laden did, I'm trying to tie this all together, but part of what the stated goal of what Bin Laden did in attacking us was not to merely just sort of kill Americans. It was to sort of, it was to bankrupt the country, and so in some respects he achieved that. The $1.28 trillion figure that I cited to you was just military and national security operations. It involved the economic consequences of going into these wars and not having money for domestic needs. And as the listener points out, you know, all the resulting economic activity that comes with spending money domestically and not abroad. And so, yeah, I mean, there is a real chance here to revisit what we were doing in terms of our spending assumptions, why we were putting so much money overseas to these wars, whether they are worth it, and whether this this incident, the killing of Bin Laden this past week, allows us the type of pivot point to readjust.
And will we readjust? It is true that we have, as Jim so eloquently said, all these underlying tough economic problems. Where are the jobs? We need jobs. Why is gas still $4.19 a gallon? Times are tough for people.
Yeah, and I think we're sort of at the time in at least domestic politics where we're being forced to readjust. And you get the sense that there's something going on. Just this week, there's going to be a vote on whether to keep tax breaks for major oil companies that have earned, you know, tens of billions of profits over the past few years. Do they need tax breaks? Well, no, they probably don't. And you actually see some Republicans who have, you know, long been champions of that tax break reconsider whether or not that's the best use of federal funds. So I think there is a readjustment going on. I don't know if it's at the point where we're starting to reconsider our foreign policy. If you happen to tune into the South Carolina Republican debate last week, you saw half the candidates out there were sort of the libertarian types who thought that we shouldn't be having an interventionist foreign policy. And so that was kind of illuminative. And I guess that, you know, we're at the point where we need to really start questioning what we're spending on. And maybe the caller has a point that we're at this philosophical point of readjustment.
Who do you see, if there is anybody, coming to the top of the group for the Republican presidential nomination? Anybody?
I wish I knew. I would put some money on it. It's a wide open field. It's filled with very interesting characters. As of now, I think you would guess that the people who aren't in the field probably stand the best chance of winning the nomination down the road, and that includes Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts, Mitch Daniels, the current governor of Indiana, even Mike Huckabee, who the former governor of Arkansas, who is now a Fox News personality. You talk to people in Democratic circles, and he probably gives them the most angst. Because in the field right now is very, I think it's objective. You can say it's very poor. It's filled with a bunch of fringe candidates and a few people who are long shots. And so it's hard to say who's going to actually emerge from that.
Uamar from Manitowoc, our next caller. Hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to respond to one of the questions you did pose to your guest, and then if I may make a couple of points, that how the Pakistan has become so-called safe haven for the so-called Muslim extremists. I think we have a short-term memory. If we know that when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, these were the same very people who fought our so-called Cold War and won for us without a single boot on the ground of Afghanistan, and then we abandoned them, and they have no way or nowhere to go, and especially after the 9/11, when we attacked the Afghanistan, the natural safe haven for them is Pakistan. And in fact, since then, Pakistan has lost more than 30,000 people to that terrorism, and now, with that situation in Pakistan, in fact, we are paying the price for that, and by we, I mean all the world, U.S. and Pakistan. Now, the question of whether it's an intelligence failure or is it a conspiracy, I think time will tell us, but it's something which is not uncommon to know in our own history of intelligence failure. 9/11 would not have happened if we did not fail the intelligence. 19 people were being trained under our nose here for months and years, and with all the resources in the world, we were not able to detect any one of them until the attack happened. And the last point I want to make is that in Pakistan, majority of the people is not terrorists. In fact, there are about 6 parties in Pakistan politics which are considered to be religious parties, and they have never won a majority of even 10% in Pakistan. So yes, there is anti-U.S. sentiment in Pakistan, but that doesn't mean that is equal to the Muslim terrorism. The reason for that anti-U.S. sentiment in Pakistan is basically of the U.S. policies and attitude and betrayed multiple times to Pakistan. And the sentiment in Pakistan, I will finish on that note, is that having a friend like U.S. who need enemy based on the history, and that's what the majority of the Pakistani people have anti-U.S. sentiment, not because they are Muslim terrorists. Otherwise, they would have a Muslim or extremist Islamic party elected, which has never happened in the 60 years history of Pakistan.
Thank you, Umar, for your call. Sam?
Yeah, I mean, there is certainly credence to that idea, and I think that was probably a big topic of discussion when we decided that it was useful for us to go into Iraq, for instance. The idea that involvement overseas like that actually worsens the situation in terms of terrorist threats as opposed to making it better. And you see that now there's people who are concerned about our intervention in Libya. We don't have necessarily all the best intelligence on what kind of political sensibilities the Libyan rebels have that we're supporting. So the caller is absolutely right. You have to ask those questions. It doesn't take away from the fact that there is a need probably and definitely in national security circles to be aggressive with the people who are threatening the country. And I think this is sort of the balance that President Obama is trying to make is, how do you go about fulfilling what are legitimate national security interests without leaving such an imprint or a footprint on the Middle East or those countries that it turns people against you. And it's a difficult balance to find.
We go to one more phone call. Your phone calls will be fine for the next guest, too. We're just going to change guests in a minute. Andy in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hi, dear. I would recommend everybody read this book. It was written actually before 9/11. It's called Jihad versus McWorld. On the cover, it shows a woman in a burqa holding a Pepsi. And what it showed was the underlying root of terrorism that bin Laden capitalized on was the men, the young men who see their women changing in front of their eyes, the fact that their social world is that of Islam and is that of a religion, and the fact they're seeing a world change out from under them, different from their fathers, okay, where the women are becoming increasingly westernized. They're bombarded by a bunch of westernized media and the like, and it turns them into very insecure people. And this is throughout the Middle East, and it's being capitalized on by demagogues, whether they're being like bin Laden or whoever they are, the Muslim Brotherhood, you see, radical Islam, to take advantage of this situation. This book was written before 9/11. I don't know if Obama read it or not. It should be required reading for everybody. This Rutgers professor really hit the nail on the head to show what the underlying root cause of terrorism is that we're confronting. And frankly, we're going to be spending a lot more dollars on this situation. It's almost like a tsunami that really is unceasing.
Thanks for the call. Well, give us your best assessment then, Sam, as to whether or not what he is describing is flourishing now. We're also seeing these huge demonstrations and changes of government in many countries in the Muslim world. So,
yeah. I mean, if you're reading international news now, you get the sense that Bin Laden's view of politics and of the Muslim world is out of fashion, and that there's this uprising in multiple countries against that type of totalitarianism, that type of extremism. I mean, you have to draw a distinction, though. One is governance or a form of governance that they're rebelling against. Another is sort of a corrupted form of religion that Bin Laden preaches. And I think the caller actually hits on something that we've been able to see from these intelligence gatherings that we've gotten from the compound, which is that Al-Qaeda really preyed on the outcasts, on people who felt sort of unwelcomed in society or repressed. And you know, the Christmas Day bomber, for instance, famously in the United States, the one who failed to blow up a plane over Detroit was this. He was a child of a very wealthy family, but he was a total social outcast. And I think that was sort of the type of person that Al-Qaeda really tried to recruit. And so, you know, there's major questions that we have in multiple elements to the story that's going on in the Middle East right now, and it's very tough to unravel, and it's very tough for the administration to unravel. I think they're going to continue following the policies they've been on, but again, this is now a point for us to look back and sort of question what our broader strategic goals are with respect to not only Al-Qaeda, but Afghanistan, Libya, even Syria.
Right. Remember how tough it was to unravel all of this 10 years ago. It was so tough.
And it's gotten only tougher.
Yeah. Thank you, Sam, so much.
Thanks for having me.
Sam Stein, political reporter for Huffington Post, based in Washington, D.C., joining us the first half of All Things Political. We're just changing guests now, still on All Things Political. Philip Klein is joining us. Philip is senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner. Before that, he worked as Washington correspondent for the American Spectator, and before that, worked for over 3 years as a financial reporter at Reuters in New York. We'll continue phone calls. This time for Philip, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Our number two of our program, there have been some questions about what our policy is on killing. Do we condone killing without a trial? Is targeted assassination a better way to go? We're going to talk about that, our number two of our show. Philip Klein, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Let's talk. Sam Stein was talking about the amount of money that we have spent to fight a war on terror and to fight wars in Libya now too, Iraq and Afghanistan since 9/11, and gave us the figure of $1.28 trillion. Considering your background as a financial reporter, what does that do for us at home to have spent that enormous amount of money fighting a war on terror?
Well, I think the thing to remember is that national security is the primary function of government. It's one of the few legitimate functions of government. If you go back to the Federalist Papers and read that, one of the few reasons for moving from the Articles of Confederation to a constitution was to have a unified national defense. And there's a good reason for that, and that's that basically that the essence of government is that we delegate to government things that we can't do by ourselves, and certain things are impractical for individuals by themselves to do, and national defense is one of them. It doesn't make sense, even though some extreme libertarians would talk about sort of competing national defense forces that you could privately invest in. I mean, that's not realistic. Practically speaking, that's a legitimate function of government. And it's easy to talk about, well, this much money's been spent, and it's easy when you don't have the counterfactual of what would be happening with terrorism if we didn't spend this money.
Mm-hmm.
How much did 9/11 cost us? How much is 3,000 innocent lives worth? So I think that it's easy now to look back on it when we have been safe for all these years in terms of major terrorist attacks and say, well, you know, was it really worth it? Well, I mean, to prevent another 9/11, I think it was worth it. We could argue about whether or not, it did, but Just to say we spent this much money doesn't mean that it wasn't worth it.
Have we made significant, or what adjective would you use to describe the progress that we have made in defeating al-Qaeda in that region?
Well, I think that, you know, it's obviously this is, you know, it's always difficult to sort of determine this sort of thing. But the indication is that they've received, they've received significant setbacks. I think the fact that we were able to get to bin Laden suggests that their influence in the region is weakening. And certainly the killing of bin Laden, and I think the subsequent video images that we see of him sort of looking, watching himself on TV huddled over in a blanket with a gray beard, you know, a knit cap outside of his sort of typical image, I think that that's all good because, you know, remember that the key thing is that although there's some dispute about how operationally involved bin Laden was, there's no doubt that he was the most charismatic leader in al-Qaeda and the inspiration. So I think that it's definitely sort of demystifying him is definitely important.
What does his death mean in terms of whether or not we should change significantly our strategy in Afghanistan?
Well, I think there are two different things. I think that the key is that we have to exit from Afghanistan in a way where the Taliban isn't in charge and it's not going to become a safe haven for terrorism. So, you know, if not bin Laden, then somebody else who comes up or other terrorist groups could sort of safely, you know, set up training camps as existed prior to 9/11. So the important thing is to you're not going to leave Afghanistan and have it look like, you know, the United States or America, but I think that you have to get to the point where you leave it where you're not putting it where it's the pre-9/11 status quo.
And what about our relationship with Pakistan? Karzai has said, look, the terrorists aren't in our country, they're in Pakistan.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that clearly this sort of renews this sort of sense of tension between the U.S. and Pakistan, the idea that he was, you know, bin Laden was found 35 miles north of Islamabad. He was found in an area where a lot of retired military live, where there's a big Pakistani military presence. And he was living sort of in a very conspicuous compound that was, according to administration sources, 8 times the size of any nearby house, and was quite, you know, it was quite transparent. You know, they were burning their own trash, and it would have been, it's hard to believe that somebody wasn't somehow aware of it. So I think that definitely is raising questions. President Obama has been guarded, and again last night in his 60 Minutes interview, he sort of reiterated that, you know, Pakistan does cooperate with us. More terrorists were killed in Pakistan than anywhere else. They do share intelligence. There's constant, you know, arguments that we'd like them to be better at it. But, you know, again, the other thing that's difficult for us to talk about is that we're not privy to a lot of things that go on behind the scenes.
Right.
So, you know, it might be that Obama's saying this because he sees all the intelligence and is aware of the fact that, you know, under the hoops, they sort of do provide assistance, even
yeah.
though it's they're sort of a popular punching bag when something like this happens.
Do you think that they may indeed have also known about what we were doing? It's sort of hard to imagine these helicopters coming in, even though it was in the dead of night, and doing this incredible action at this compound, which is next to their military academy, without their knowing. I mean, they didn't take action against us, and they probably had time to take action against us. It makes you wonder if somebody didn't know what the heck was going on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, that's just purely speculation.
Exactly,
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, the White House has said that you know, that even some of Obama said last night, again, going back to the 60 Minutes interview, that even some of his closest aides
didn't know,
weren't aware of this.
His wife didn't know, he said. Yeah, they didn't.
Yeah, nobody even knew. His family didn't know. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's, I mean, and again, it was the way the helicopters were designed, and I guess it's possible that it could have, you know, they could have gone in and out. I mean, they were there for 40 minutes. By the time, you know, someone may have reacted, it might have been too late to figure out what was going on. So maybe people did turn the other way. I guess it's too hard to know.
Yeah. Let's go to phone calls. Tony on the phone from Janesville. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a point. I think if you considered America and more of a macro viewpoint and how we spend our money, I think almost anybody would agree that it's kind of useless the way we have spent it. You're talking about the $1.28 trillion that, you know, we spend on this terrorism. And I think if you took a five-year-old and their moral standpoint, they could run our country better. And the reason that we're spending this money in the first place is a direct result of the things that we've already done in the past that, you know, weren't good moral decisions. And I guess I can take my comment off the air. I think there's definitely something to be said about that.
Thank you, Tony, for the call. Philip.
There definitely is one strand of argument that basically we wouldn't have these problems with terrorism if we had taken different actions beforehand, if we weren't meddling in the Middle East and so forth. That's one strand of argument. It's not something I agree with. I think that sometimes there are bad people in the world that want to do bad things, and that it's, especially if you look at the history and the development of radical Islam and its roots in this sort of rebellion against modernity, the idea of corrupting the purity of Islam and wanting to return to the pure Islam and restore the caliphate. And if you look at the sort of development of it in the 20s in Egypt and with the Brotherhood, and you read, you know, Hassan al-Banna and so forth, I think it's pretty clear that if you study it, that things were building towards this point. And it just so happens that, you know, America is the sort of the biggest representation of Westernization and of modernity, and that's the biggest threat to the view of purist Islam.
We take more phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political on the Ideas Network, and our guest this half hour is Philip Klein, senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner. Our number, a couple lines are open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Our thoughts, of course, still very much in international relations frame of mind because of the death of Osama bin Laden, the president's appearance last night on 60 Minutes. The Pakistani television, this is a story that some places are reporting on today, Pakistani media reporting what they say is the name of a CIA station chief in Islamabad. The Associated Press has learned the name being reported is incorrect, but why are they doing such a thing? What about our relations with Pakistan? Those are front and center, and the direction of the war in Afghanistan and the amount of money that has been spent on all of this, how successful it has been, the impact it's had on the U.S. economy. But bring us into other areas if you'd like. It is, after all things political. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Daryl from Couderay, our next caller. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning, Kathleen and your guest. I had a comment and a question, but first I'd like to say I think it's all a lot simpler than we are told, but your earlier guest said that we're spending all this money for wars, yet he said no money for domestic programs. But aren't the bankers and the bank bailouts of $3 trillion plus, that's trillion with a T, domestic spending, but only for the rich. I mean the super-duper rich. And now with Osama dead, just like Saddam is dead, so no questions can be asked of either. Isn't that just a little too convenient, or am I missing something? Or is America really being taken for a long, ugly ride that we could do without?
Philip?
I guess there's a few things to say on that. The idea that somehow we're spending more money on the war and we're not spending money on social programs is, you know, factually untrue. I mean, the defense budget is roughly 18% of the overall budget. Most of the budget is made up by things such as, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. You know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid would, in 1 year, far eclipse the whole cost of the Iraq and Afghanistan campaigns. So the primary drivers of spending are the entitlement programs and social programs. So that's just not, you know, not borne out by the fact. On the Wall Street bailouts, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, that costs money. The difference is that technically from a budgetary standpoint, the reason why that's different is that the Wall Street banks have to pay back the money. So it won't have the same budgetary effect as, let's say, if you spend money that you don't get back in any other way. That's not to say that the, you know, bailout is a good thing or that there aren't other criticisms of bailing out Wall Street banks and so forth. But just in terms of if we're talking a pure budgetary standpoint, you can talk about, you know, the $700 billion Wall Street bailout as if it's fully expended, the full expenditure of $700 billion.
Do you think that military spending needs to be under careful consideration, cuts therein, in order to deal with the debt?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the question is, I don't think that military spending should be cut to deal with the debt. I think that if you look through the military budget and there are programs that we don't need and there are ways to spend the money more efficiently without sacrificing national security, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's something, you know, there are ways that you could look at that. But the danger in using the, you know, looking to the military budget as a budgetary spending problem is just that we never know where the threats are going to come from. And the difficulty is that if you look, for instance, how long it took us to get up to speed during World War II when we were caught off guard and we weren't spending that much money in the military. And another example would be on 9/11. During the 90s, we had what was called the so-called peace dividend. After the Cold War, people didn't, you know, think that we were going to face these major threats, and we cut the military significantly during the 90s, and that didn't do us well in this decade. And I think it's a big danger, and I think that's one of the reasons why we have to get entitlements under control, because especially with China growing and investing more money as a percentage of its GDP than the United States, and with their GDP set to eclipse the United States by some measures within 5 years, I think that American military supremacy, you know, could be a fading thing if we decide that that's the way that we're going to reduce the spending. I think it's a big danger. I think that one of the reasons, in fact, that we have to get entitlement spending under control is so that we could maintain our military advantage.
Daryl, thanks very much for the call. Kaiser in Germantown. Hi.
Yes, Mike, I have a couple of comments, and I'll try to ask a question after that. You know, we have to recognize one man's terrorist could be another man's freedom fighter. For example, looking at World War II, we cannot find anything. The West, in fact, cannot say anything bad about Winston Churchill. But that man was responsible for taking all the grains from India
resulting in 3 million Indians starved to death. But people of this country do not know about it. We see him as a great hero, a great fighter. And similarly, you know, we need to find out why do we have these terrorists that are sprouting in Middle East? They are coming from, why are they, what is happening in the Middle East? Why are they coming up? I remember the speech by George Bush where he outlined three axes of evil. The next day, a U.S. Arab paper came up with its three axes of evil. One was U.S. foreign policy, second was all the Arab leaders, third was State of Israel. Well, the Arabs, the population of the Middle East has started revolting against its Arab leaders, who pretty much were supported by us for the longest time, and they suppressed the people. Now, what do we need to do to change our foreign policy and convince the terrorist State of Israel to treat its people and learn to coexist with the State of Palestine? Why do we have one set of standards for Muslims and another set of standards for Israelis? And I am not a Palestinian. I'm a Pakistani American. I wish one of these days you would invite an expert from Pakistan to tell you why are they having a hard time cooperating with us when it comes to Taliban.
All right, let's get a response. Philip.
Well, I mean, I think two things. One is I don't think that Israel, I think that a lot of people who hate Israel and have hostility towards the Jewish state will like to try to blame that for anything that goes wrong in the world. And it's sort of pretty typical. It's an unfortunate attitude that people have to try to create some sort of linkage between Israel and the rest of the region. I'm not saying that it's not one of many factors that influence geopolitical environment in that region, but the centrality that people put on it I think is pretty disturbing. And as far as calling Israel a terrorist nation, I think that's a pretty disgusting smear on the only true democracy in the Middle East that is constantly under threat of invasion and terrorist attack. And
let's go to
the real terrorists in that region are groups like Hamas and Hezbollah that are supported by Iran and radical Islamic groups.
David in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have three very quick comments. Appreciate it. First of all, I want to commend the Wisconsin Public Radio for having this guest on, who is obviously has very extreme right-wing and libertarian viewpoints, witness his comments about the only legitimate things that government should do. So I'm sure the guest who's on WPR this today is lockstep in favor of getting rid of every tax dollar to support public radio. So I commend WPR.
Are you in favor of that, Philip?
I don't think that the government should fund public radio, no.
That was obvious from his perspective. The other thing is, too, the second point, very quickly, so I commend WPR. Second, he mentioned there was $1.285 trillion spent on the war on terror, but forgot to mention that more than half of that was in Iraq, which originally had nothing to do with the war on terror and al-Qaeda, except it was the Bush misstep. But third, the Federalist 10 paper that the guest referenced about the national defense being the only legitimate or one of only two legitimate government things to do, conveniently forgot the failed Constitutional Convention in Annapolis of 1786, out of which the call came for the convention in Philadelphia in 1787, which included a very much strengthened commerce clause, which gave the newly forming federal government the opportunity to address things such as infrastructure beyond national defense and also including where necessary and proper social programs. So the listeners in the area here should know that there's certainly a different perspectives from that time frame too. Mm-hmm. Washington didn't think we should be involved in European matters, let alone the Middle East. So thanks for letting this person on, and also for allowing me to talk about his hope.
Thanks, David. Yeah, thanks for the call. Philip, we have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, well, I think the key thing on that is that the Commerce Clause, the way it was written, was to regulate commerce among the states, as in ensure the free flow of commerce between the states, so that you wouldn't have tariffs between, let's say, Virginia and North Carolina, so commerce could freely flow. It's been perverted over the decades to mean that government could regulate everything under the sun, including now they're trying to say that it could force you to purchase private insurance.
Thank you, Philip, very much for being with us on our All Things Political. Our guest, last half hour, Philip Klein, senior writer for the Washington Examiner. Prior to that position, he was Washington correspondent for the American Spectator. Sam Stein, political reporter for Huffington Post, with us the first half hour of All Things Political. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios, and thanks for all of your calls, everyone. We have news coming up from National Public Radio and a philosophical discussion based on the Bible and based on government, and it'll be interesting. Stay with us.